time for The Outspoken Cyclist, your weekly conversation about bicycles, cycling, and related topics. The Outspoken Cyclist on-air show is heard every Saturday morning, 7:30 a.m. in northeastern Ohio on WJCU 88.7 FM and streamed at WJCU.org. Our weekly podcast is available at the close of the on-air show at OutspokenCyclist.com or download it with your favorite podcatching app to listen anytime. Now here's your host, Diane Jenks.
Hello and welcome to The Outspoken Cyclist. I'm your host, Diane Jenks. This is our show for August 8th, 2020. I think we have a rather nice variety of topics and guests this evening, so let's get right to it. With the perhaps self-imposed mandate, depending on where you live, of course, of staying home or going for a solo ride, maybe you've run out of good television to watch or books to read. That's highly unlikely, but you get my point. How about a good story? Or how about an hour of good stories? And an hour of good stories about bicycles. Akin to the Moth Radio Hour format comes Bike Minds. Back in May, we spoke with Matt Pinder up in Toronto. He's the guy who writes the Beyond the Automobile blog and is a senior designer at Alta Planning. Well, he has another gig, and you are invited to the party. Next week, you can tune in to his first virtual edition of Bike Minds, Bikes plus Fate. It's a storytelling event featuring positive and inspiring stories related to cycling. And in this episode, there'll be several stories from folks all across Canada. Then we meet a colleague of mine, Larry Silver. So I actually just met Larry in a virtual meeting of the East Coast Greenway Advisory Board. He lives in Philadelphia, but he's from Cleveland. I'm from Philadelphia, and I live in Cleveland. Coincidence? I think not. But that's not the important part anyway. He's the chairman of the East Coast Greenway Board and has a long history of bicycling, environmental causes, and he's a practicing attorney. Then we head to Colorado to speak with Lucy Diaz. She's the CEO of RPM Events and the Colorado Classic. With heavy heart, she pulled the plug on the event this year, but in an incredibly magnanimous gesture, she made the COVID-19 mitigation manual available to anyone who might want to read it, study it, take the enormous amount of work that went into it, and make it their own. So first, let's head up to Toronto to speak with Matt Pinder about Bike Minds. Hi, Matt. Welcome back to The Outspoken Cyclist. Thanks for joining me this morning.
Hi, Diane. Thanks so much for having me.
It's my pleasure. It's good to talk with you again. I take it all is well in Canada.
Everything is going as well as it could be.
Given the circumstances. Well, today we're going to talk about bicycle stories, which I think is a really good idea. You know, we're all kind of hunkering down, looking for things to do. And if people listen to the Moth Radio Hour, they tell stories. And what we're going to talk about today is Bike Minds, your bike stories. So tell us what it is, Bike Minds, and what happens during your event.
So Bike Minds is a bicycle-themed storytelling event where stories are shared from a range of storytellers of diverse backgrounds with the mission of changing the way that you think about people who ride bikes. And we do that with a few simple ground rules. Stories have to be positive. So we're not going to hear stories about bike theft or a bike collision. Stories have to be personal. We want to know what happened to you, not about your organization or your job. And they have to be inspiring. And that's probably the hardest part. We scour the web, we scour social networks for bike stories that are unique in some way and have an inspiring lesson to them. And then the other unique part about Bike Minds is that we make an active effort to create space for storytellers who aren't typically represented in the cycling community. You know, we've talked about this when I was on the show before, Diane, the profile of a cyclist being this fit, middle-aged man. Well, when we pick our storytellers for Bike Minds, we actively try to disassemble that stereotype by showing the diverse range of people who actually do ride bikes.
It just sounds like fun, and I love the positive, personal, inspiring background to it. Tell us how the event works.
It's pretty straightforward. Up until now, we've done our events in person. We'll have 5 or 6 storytellers that each get about 7 minutes. After each story, there's 2 or 3 minutes of audience question and answers. And then we break the formal part of the evening. And usually we're at a bar and there's some drinks and people get a chance to mingle with each other and the storytellers. Now, this time we're doing it a little bit differently. In-person events are not so much an option at this point in time. So we're trying our first online event, and it's going to follow roughly the same format, but with a little bit different type of audience engagement, of course. It'll be audience sending questions through Zoom chat, and then we'll get people to post some commentary throughout. But yeah, that's about how it goes. It's 1 hour to 1.5 hours long.
You are going to be using the Zoom format.
Yes, exactly.
Yeah. I guess up until now, when I look at the website, Bike Minds website, it has a lot of attendees. So clearly these have been not only interesting, but well-attended events. How are you letting people know about your online event? I mean, that's what we're going to do today, but how are you letting people know?
Well, we're getting the word out through social media, through our website, through our mailing list. Our storytellers for this event are from across Canada. So they're going to be promoting to their social networks as well. And we're counting on folks like you, Diane, and your podcast to get the word out. We're really trying to go as broad geographically as possible. And this is probably going to be our first of a few virtual events. So, you know, this time we're showing stories from across Canada, but next time we would really like to be able to include some folks south of the border as well.
Let me remind our listeners, we're speaking with Matt Pinder. We have spoken with him in the past about some of the work that he does. This is sort of a fun event, Bike Minds. This one's coming up next Wednesday, August 12th. Is that correct?
Yes, at 8 p.m. Eastern.
Okay, so if you're in a different time zone, you know, you'll just back those hours off. And before we sign off, we will give people a way where they can sign on. It is a non-charging event, so it is free.
Yes, all of our events are completely free to attend. We prioritize being a zero-cost event so that we can be as accessible as possible.
Give us an example of one of your storytellers coming up this time.
I'd be happy to. So one storyteller in particular that I'm looking forward to, his name is Arcee, and he is a bicycle mayor. Is that a program that you're familiar with?
Or maybe
no. You've had someone on your show?
No.
It is an international group of dedicated people who are leaders in their cycling community in their city. And this organization kind of instills the title of bicycle mayor onto one person per city. And Arcee is the bicycle mayor of the city of Waterloo, which is near Toronto in Ontario, Canada. And Arcee is going to tell the story of his experience immigrating to Canada and using a bike just as a tool for everyday life, but eventually realizing that there is a lot of community to be found through cycling. And eventually he got involved in cycling leadership in his community. He got involved in Bike to Work Month and that type of programming. And you could say risen to the top of his city cycling community and is now really a prominent leader.
That's very cool. I just found the Bicycle Mayor website and I will contact them. That looks like such a fun thing.
Yeah.
You've picked all Canadian storytellers this time. Are you hoping that when somebody here in the U.S. or even beyond that hears what you're doing, they're going to volunteer as a storyteller? And then what do you do, vet them?
Yeah, that's exactly what we're hoping for. We have a story submission portal on our website that is always open. We chose Canada for this one just because we wanted to establish some boundaries, but I already have some people on my list that I want to reach out to when we do our next event from the States. And I will say that another priority of ours is not to share the stories of the people that you already know, maybe the people who are really prominent in the cycling community, but also find people that you have never heard of who, you know, are very ordinary in their own lives, but have something extraordinary to talk about when it comes to cycling. So if one of your listeners fits that profile, I really hope that they'll consider submitting a story to us.
Well, and we will post that link also. You know what, Matt? This sounds like so much fun. I will be rushing back from yoga Wednesday night to tune in and hear some of the stories. We've been speaking with Matt Pinder. His event is Bike Minds. You can go to, I think it's bikeminds.com or is it .ca? Let's see. bikeminds.ca. And because Matt's in Canada, we knew that. And again, the website will give you all the information. You'll be able to attend the event. You'll be able to hear stories. You'll be able to become a storyteller, which is what Matt's looking for, more stories to make cycling more accessible. Matt, thank you so much for talking with me. I know you've got a lot to do. Me too. And I look forward to hearing stories next Wednesday.
Thanks so much, Diane. Take care.
You too. Have a great week. Matt Pinder joined me from his home in Toronto to talk about Bike Minds, an evening of storytelling for your enjoyment. If you are interested in registering for the free event, you can log on to bikeminds.ca. And while you're there, you can also sign up for the mailing list for future events. So let's take a short break, and when we return, we'll speak with East Coast Greenway's Chairman of the Board, Larry Silver. You're listening to The Outspoken Cyclist. We are back on The Outspoken Cyclist. I'm your host, Diane Jenks. We've had a lot of conversation over the past few weeks about diversity, inclusion, and equity. And having another one made me think about all the pushback I got when we reported on Lance Armstrong as his franchise began to unravel a few years ago. But today the conversation is much lighter and looks at the topics from a totally different perspective, one that's already working. The already diverse use of trails. Larry is committed to improving bike access across Philadelphia, and he puts his time and energy where his mouth is. Hello, Larry. Welcome to The Outspoken Cyclist. Thanks for being my guest.
I'm very happy to be here. Thanks, Diane.
Well, it was nice to actually virtually meet you at the East Coast Greenway Board Advisory Board meeting last week. That was kind of fun to see all those faces. I've seen names and had conversations, but don't get to actually see people. That was a good meeting, don't you think?
I thought it was a fantastic meeting. There were so many interesting, different perspectives. What I really loved about it is I always feel like I can learn from people the less I know about their background. And that's what's wonderful about diversity. We have an incredibly great, diverse, interesting advisory board, people coming from different geographical locations, different backgrounds, and having a different take on the subject that we all like and find important, which is trails and alternative ways of travel. And it was just an amazing session.
It was great. I really enjoyed it. It's the best one I've been to. So you and I have some connections, which now we're aware of the connections. One is, of course, to the Greenway that we're both on the board, and the other is to both Philadelphia and Cleveland. So I was born in Philadelphia. You are in Philadelphia. You were born in Cleveland. I am in Cleveland. It's just one of those kind of serendipitous things, small world.
Right. And, of course, I'm still a great Cleveland lover. I get back often to visit family. And, of course, a big Cleveland sports fan. You can't grow up in Cleveland without being a sports fan. And it's a wonderful place. In fact, I traveled to Cleveland. I called it the Hajj when the Cavaliers won the championship in 2016. People were coming from all over the country. And I remember spending time with my sister and brother-in-law and then traveling down for the big parade. And you really couldn't travel all the way down to Cleveland, center of Cleveland, for the parade because it was so crowded. The best way to get into the city was to park far away or in walk or bicycles. Bicyclists were going in droves into towns. That was the easiest way to get downtown during those exciting days.
Yes, Cleveland does love its sports. That is true. And they don't like anything better than a winner. And that was a winner. That was a pretty interesting time. So you have a really interesting history that has kept you connected to bicycling and the environment, both things that, of course, fascinate and interest me, and we talk about a lot on the show. Give us a little bit of background about you and how your work informs your cycling and kind of vice versa.
Well, it's kind of interesting. I mean, I got started bicycling when I was a kid. I had a paper route. I actually entered a contest with the newspaper and won a bicycle.
Really?
I finished second. The contest was to sign up as many new subscribers as possible. And my mother decided she was going to make sure at least I finished in the top few. So she helped out. The first prize was a trip to Disneyland, not Disney World.
Right.
This was pre-Disney World. And the second prize was a brand new, very beautiful bicycle. And I won the second prize, which meant I could enjoy it for several years.
So was that the Cleveland Press or the Cleveland Plain Dealer?
This was the Press. And I did a lot of bicycling in high school. I took a couple of trips to Europe, one after the freshman year in college with a high school buddy. We spent about 6 or 8 weeks bicycling around France. I took a second trip just before I went to law school and biked in northern France and England. And I've always liked bicycling, and I've always liked the outdoors, and that sort of led me to trails. Work-wise, I went to law school in Berkeley, got an urban studies master's degree from Cleveland State University, undergrad at the University of Chicago in economics, and migrated my way into working for an environmental consulting firm in San Francisco, and then concentrated on environmental law and law school in my practice ever since. I've always been interested in the outdoors, and I've been interested in conservation and preservation and environmental justice from a pretty early age. And so a lot of those things mixed quite well with my interest in trails and biking.
Let me remind our listeners, we're speaking with Larry Silver. He is the board chair of the East Coast Greenway. Disclaimer here, I am also a member of the advisory board, as most of you know, on the East Coast Greenway. I got to actually wave to Larry yesterday, or last week, I should say, in a Zoom board meeting, which was kind of fun to see all those faces, as we alluded to at the beginning of the conversation. I'd like to know about your work with the East Coast Greenway and the environment, but I'd also like to know, because of what's going on with the pandemic and with the way cities in specifically are dealing with traffic and roads, what's going on in Philadelphia and what is your current thinking about how the city or you are able to ride?
Well, I do have some personal experience on it. I am a bike commuter in Philadelphia from a near-in suburb called Narberth, which is about 10 miles west of Center City, Philadelphia. And I bike through various parts of the city and Fairmount Park to get into Center City, some on-road, some off-road, some trails, some in city streets. So what I observed right after the pandemic started, of course, was, well, biking was easier because there was less traffic. That eventually sort of started to come back. So I kind of enjoyed the low traffic volume. Some people have said that the drivers are a little bit faster and wilder during the pandemic. I kind of haven't really observed that on my personal commute. My rule of thumb is when I'm biking on Philadelphia city streets is that 10% of people are very polite, 10% of drivers are very impolite, and the remaining 80% are reasonably polite.
So, that's an interesting perspective.
So you have to watch out for the worst 10%. But generally speaking, the biggest impact, in my view, of the pandemic is sometimes when there are societal changes like this, even if they're temporary, it allows people to experiment more. So while we were having fewer cars on the streets, restaurants which needed to open outdoors to really to survive started informally and then with the city's help, putting tables and chairs onto sidewalks or even expanding into the streets for a few feet where there were parking lanes, for example. So what we've gotten is we've started to think about the city and think about the streetscape in a somewhat different way, at least temporarily. And sometimes temporary changes lead to permanent changes because people think differently about space. So one way that I think about it is in a crowded city like Philadelphia, more of a European style city, there's a lot of competition for street space, parking lanes, bike lanes, pedestrians are all competing for the same geography. For example, in Philadelphia, when a couple of lanes were opened up on two streets in Center City, Pine Street being one of them, there was a question about taking a parking lane away, a lot of anger about that. So a compromise was made to put in a bike lane, but leave parking only on Sunday because there were churches along a particular street that really needed the parking spaces for churchgoers. So that's an example of the constant competition for geography in a European-style city like Philadelphia or along the East Coast. This pandemic has given people an opportunity to think a little bit differently about the geography because of fewer parked cars. That opens up space for different concepts, wider sidewalks, sidewalk cafes, bike lanes, etc. And some of those are going to take if and when the pandemic ends. So that's kind of one of the ways I think about, you know, the impact the pandemic can have on trails and biking and things that I think improve the city.
How much support from government are you getting, or is Philadelphia getting, to accommodate cyclists and walkers and business owners who are looking at this expanded opportunity on a sidewalk or even into the parking lane, these sort of pop-up outdoor, you know, al fresco restaurants, which of course to me is like, that's the way to live. But, you know, I know a lot of people probably don't look at it that way. And Philadelphia is a tough city to drive in the first place.
Sure is. No question.
So are you getting some support from government?
Well, you do. You know, government is, I guess if I were a political scientist, I would say governments are pluralistic. There are a number of different interests competing all of the time. One of the advantages for those that favor better use of sidewalks, multiple use of streets, favoring small businesses, for example, is that there's not as much vocal opposition right now from car-centric interests because they're not using the streets as much and they're not using the parking lanes as much. So this is a time that in which the interests that support different uses of streets and sidewalks can have some sway because there's sort of a feeling that it's only temporary. But as I said, temporary sometimes turns out to be such a great idea that it becomes permanent. So that's what I'm hoping happens here. So the city being in the middle tends to say, okay, let's give this a shot. The opposition isn't as strong as it was, say, 2 years ago.
That's a good thing. Once again, let me remind our listeners, we're speaking with Larry Silver. He's an attorney in Philadelphia. He commutes on his bicycle. I guess it's around 20 miles round trip when he's there. He's not there right now, but he's having fun. And he's done a lot of things in the bicycle world. In fact, he pretty much lives in the environmental world, which is a big part of cycling to me. So let's talk a little bit about the Greenway and your role. You're actually the chair of the board. Tell us how you got involved with the East Coast Greenway and what the Philadelphia section, if there is one, what the Pennsylvania section looks like, and what keeps you sort of connected to the board? I know I'm in Cleveland, which seems like it's really far away, but I have a different kind of connection to it. So,
yeah, well, I got involved in the board almost by serendipity. I was on a bike ride sponsored by the Bicycle Coalition of Philadelphia, which was an annual ride for several years in the area, in the city, and then into the suburbs. And at the end of the ride, I met somebody who was one of the trail coordinators for the East Coast Greenway Alliance, and he was looking for some space in Center City to have an office. He thought that would be more convenient. And I said, you know, we've got an extra room or two in our law firm. This was back in 2008 or so. And he said, great. And he set up there, and I got to know the ECGA, the East Coast Greenway Alliance, through him, and eventually got invited onto the board and been on the board about 7 or 8 years now. And eventually somebody asked me if I wanted to be the board chair, and I said, sure. And that's where I am.
So what are some of the duties as the chair? I mean, you know, I do a lot of work with the media and getting some of the word out about the Greenway, but you must have a much more all-encompassing role.
Well, board chair, there's a natural split between staff and board. The leader of the staff is the executive director, and the executive director, his role is to administer the everyday activities of the alliance, and the alliance's goal is basically to complete the East Coast Greenway from Maine to Florida, and we have trail coordinators and up and down the coast that lobby and get the word out about connecting local trails and raising money and identifying gaps in the trail. We have about a little over 30% of the trail done in the East Coast. Yeah, and we work with state and local groups and government and the federal government to try to find funding and design and engineer trails with local help to complete the route, the entire in excess of 3,000-mile route. So that's what the staff does on a day-to-day basis. The executive director also is a leader in raising awareness and raising money for the East Coast Greenway Alliance. The board is sort of an oversight function and hires the executive director, also raises money, raises awareness, is essentially sort of like a board of a corporation. This is a nonprofit corporation, of course, and assists the staff in meeting its long-term goals of building this amazing trail. Also setting policies in terms of trail design, in terms of safety and other factors for the trail itself.
Well, and the trail is getting done in sections. When do you see or do you see an end day? It may never be done in some ways, because of course there'll always be work being done on the trail, but as far as getting the whole thing connected from Maine to Florida, do you see a timeline where we'll live to see it?
Well, you know, obviously the right analogy is the Appalachian Trail, which was conceived in the late teens, early 1920s, and took, 40 or 50 years to build.
Right.
Difference for us is we are going city to city. We connect all of the major cities of the East Coast and go right through the heart of the major cities of the East Coast, plus, you know, mid-sized cities, you know, Boston, Portland, Maine, Hartford, Connecticut, Providence, Rhode Island, New York City, Jersey City, Newark, Trenton, right on down the line, Philadelphia, Washington, D.C., Baltimore, all the way, you know, Richmond, Virginia, all the way down through Miami, Florida, on to Key West. and I missed several on the way. So there are, you know, complications of getting through urban areas, getting funding, working with local trail groups. It's a complex project, but it's an amazing project, and it has so many benefits. One of my focuses is making sure that underserved areas and cities and towns get access to trails, where there really is going to be a great benefit. I always look at a trail as a place to breathe in an urban area. And during the time I'm as board chair, that's going to be one of my focuses. In terms of how long this is all going to take, we envision 25 or 30 years to finish.
That's not horrible. It's taken a lot longer than that with some of the projects here in Cleveland, for example, and you would know about this, the towpath, which is just now being completed into downtown. And I can remember talking about this at my old store back in the late 80s. Things just take a really, really long time sometimes. Talk to me a little bit about diversity and how diversity will play into the use of these trails, because you talk about having underserved areas having access.
Well, for one thing, a trail is not just for bicyclists. It's for pedestrians. It's for all modes of persons who travel in different ways. If you go down to any major trail along our route, you will see parents pushing baby carriages. You'll see children on tricycles. You'll see all sorts of different modes of transportation, which is a great thing. But you also see diversity in terms of age, diversity in terms of race, in terms of income levels. Trails can be very democratic places. And trails are often near water bodies, too. The history of cities along the East Coast, Philadelphia in particular, is that for many years, the water's edge of the rivers were sort of used for industrial purposes or highways. And over the last 20 or 30 years, people start to recognize the importance of waterways and greenways along waterways as being really important for people's health, for exercise, and for all sorts of positive life experiences. So that is something that should be spread among everyone. There's an environmental justice component to trails and access to trails, and it improves people's lives and improves people's lives in all strata and people from all walks of life. So that to me is one of the really great things about what we're doing, since we are a very urban oriented route.
So the last thing I want to talk about are future projects in which you might be involved and what is coming up next for you and then for the Greenway as a whole.
Well, one of the things that the Greenway is, you know, we're obviously working very hard to complete our trail, you know, so that's segment by segment. We're looking for to do some very interactive things on the trail in terms of nearby amenities. In Connecticut, we're working on an interactive program. My particular interest is history. The East Coast is full of great history, both Western civilization and Native American history. And I'd like very much to focus our efforts on coordinating and understanding the historical roots of the geography we go through, and making that an element of the trail experience for our users.
Wow, that's fascinating. We've been speaking with Larry Silver. He is the chair board for the East Coast Greenway Alliance. If you are interested in knowing more about the East Coast Greenway, great website, greenway.org. And Larry, thank you so much for taking time to talk with me today. I hope you're staying safe. Are you able to ride out on the shore? I know you're not in the city right now.
I already rode out this morning, and I'm going to do an evening ride when the weather cools.
Great. We will talk again. I am sure we will see each other, at least if not in person, we'll wave online. Thank you so much. Have a great afternoon.
You're welcome. Thanks very much.
All right. Bye-bye. Larry Silver is the chairman of the board of the East Coast Greenway. If you're interested in knowing more about the 3,000-mile route from Maine to Florida, you can log on to greenway.org. So let's take another short break, and when we come back, we'll speak with Lucy Diaz, the CEO of RPM Events and the Colorado Classic. You're listening to The Outspoken Cyclist.
You're listening to the station that is your home for college radio in Cleveland, 88.7 FM, WJCU, University Heights.
We are back on The Outspoken Cyclist. I'm Diane Jenks. As with most of the events that involve bicycle racing, bicycle touring, and even some recreational rides, the Colorado Classic has been postponed until 2021. But when COVID raised its ugly head, RPM Events and the Colorado Classic went to work dissecting every aspect of a bike event, from planning to execution, and turned it into a manual. And they've made it available if anyone wants to use it. Hello, Lucy. Welcome to The Outspoken Cyclist. Thanks for joining me on the show this week.
Thanks for having me. Excited to be here.
Oh, it's my pleasure. You know, we've covered the Colorado Classic for several years every time it comes up, but the current state of things is a little bit different. Everything's been canceled or postponed. You guys are doing something really, really interesting. I read it in my Endurance Sports Wire press release a couple of days ago. Can you tell us a little bit about your COVID mitigation plan?
Yes, absolutely. Well, I will say, and I'm sure you saw it, but we did actually cancel our 2020 event a few weeks ago now. But in light of that, we had done a lot of work over the last 3 months to build a COVID mitigation plan. And some of that was out of necessity in order to get the approvals that we needed from the state. But all of that was out of responsibility and communication and really wanting to have a concrete and tight plan around, you know, our ways to keep the athletes safe. And really to communicate the responsibility and the steps that we've taken or had taken to ensure safety for the event. So unfortunately, as we sit here today, we will not be able to utilize that manual for our own event. But we thought that even though we couldn't use it, why should we keep it to ourselves? Again, we spent 3 months working on it with a lot of different groups and a lot of different collaborations. So why not publish it and allow others to dig into it and see if it applies to their event? It's obviously through the lens of a professional cycling event, but you know, there could be tidbits in there that are applicable to ski resorts or to Grand Fondos or other types of events that are taking place during this time frame. So we hope that this will help somebody else out, you know, as they drive towards planning of their event.
Well, that's pretty magnanimous to make it available to others. I realize a lot went into planning it. So do you think, and this, I know you didn't know this question was coming.
That's okay.
It's really an opinion. Do you think that you are going to, or other events are going to need this kind of a mitigation plan going forward, even beyond 2020? Do you think this is kind of an ongoing way of looking at events in the future, some of this, or if not all of it?
I do. I mean, I definitely think elements of it are. And it's just the same way that I was saying something to a friend of mine last night. And it's, you know, I've always been, I think, a safe and healthy person, you know, washing your hands when it's necessary. But now it's, I mean, obviously just wearing masks and it's become commonplace and people are doing that. When will we stop wearing masks? I mean, that's the question that we don't know. When will we need to do that? So I think, you know, there really isn't a finite end to the journey that is COVID, especially as it relates to events. And, you know, I've run marathons, I've raced in mass participation events, and you're standing shoulder to shoulder with someone you don't know who's sweating, who's breathing heavily. And now when you think about that, especially from event producer's perspective, you go, oh my gosh, that's I can't believe we ever did that. That is, it's sort of this huge revelation of like, it wasn't ever healthy perhaps or safe to be doing that, but we didn't have this, daunting virus that was really driving us to say, oh gosh, we can't do this at all. So, you know, I say all of that to say that I think events will look different. I think especially mass participatory events will look different as we move forward. And that some of the elements that are within this guide will definitely be applicable to that. And it's even if it's just, you know, the way that and in our instance, we weren't having fans, so we don't really address any sort of fan athlete engagement. But, you know, you think about it, and something we talked about when making the decision to remove the fans from the equation was really these athletes, you know, specifically in pro cycling, you know, their immune systems are depressed when they're finished, right? So they've raced for 60, 70, 80 miles. You know, they've been redlining heart rates. You know, they've been going hard for, you know, up to 3 hours at a time. And the fact that people want to shake their hands and pat their backs and, you know, take pictures with them after the race, you know, now you say, gosh, maybe that wasn't the right thing to do. Who knows where this you know, spectator or, you know, this fan is coming from. So it just, it really, all of this has caused pause for us to think of, you know, what is the safe way of moving forward. Now, all of that said, is we can't overwhelm ourselves and keep ourselves in a complete bubble. But it does add a list of considerations that you wouldn't have otherwise thought.
Right. Let me take a moment to remind our listeners we're speaking with Lucy Diaz. She is the CEO of RPM Events Group, which produces the Colorado Classic, postponed for 2020, but with some new ideas for other race directors, ride directors who might be able to go forward with an event this year. Colorado Classic hopefully will be back in 2021. Talk us through just a couple of the pieces of the plan. You said it was a collaborative process. Who else besides RPM worked on the plan? And then tell us a little bit how the plan works.
Yeah, that's a great question. And we were learning day by day and sort of trying to understand what we need. There's no roadmap within this COVID era of planning events. And early on in the conversation, we work with Medalist Sports. They manage all the technical side of the race. So they manage all the field of play. And they have a team of tech directors and event managers. And, you know, they have a pretty comprehensive team. And we've worked with them all 4 years of the event. And they're a great partner of ours. And on an early conversation with them, the first thing we did is we internally anointed, if you will, someone as our COVID czar. That's what we were calling it internally. But really, the role of that person was to amass all of the information that was out there. And it's even just those that weren't in, you know, event planning during the outbreak of COVID. Things were changing on a daily, hourly basis. And you were getting different types of information, whether it was from the CDC or whether it was from the state health department or from the counties. Because the event would have operated in four different counties throughout the state of Colorado. And each of the counties have different comfort levels with gatherings and all of that. So there's a lot of information that's coming in from different sources. So we had appointed somebody internally to amass all that information and help us digest it and help us understand as a group, what of that information is relevant and how do we interpret that? And then how do we take that information and create guidelines around the event? So that, you know, that first phase of the process was probably a month to 6 weeks. And again, as I was saying, and as we all witnessed and have lived through, things were changing rapidly. So it was trying to keep up to date, but it was nice in knowing if you read something or you saw something, you know, we all collectively would pass it on to this individual and he would amass it and he would keep a running document, you know, and what I failed to mention earlier is, you know, we took USA Cycling, they had put together a risk mitigation. That's a tongue twister.
Yeah, it is.
Tool around forced cycling specifically. We looked at what triathlon was doing. We took what the guidelines that UCI had put out. We were looking into other sports. You know, I mentioned triathlon, but other sports as well, even, you know, on a major league baseball level or NBA. So really trying to understand and distill into a best practice of how to operate in these terms. Once we were able to pull that together and understand the protocols, we then brought in the next layer of the medical support. So from the medical community. So we had been speaking with Dr. Rashan, who is with USA Cycling. He is their chief medical officer. We had brought a woman by the name of Roberta Smith, and she was actually a volunteer and was fantastically helpful in this process. She was a nurse and had worked in epidemiology, so understood just even the terms, right? Like, I don't understand all the medical terms and I'm not claiming to be a doctor in all of that. So really having the help and the support of, you know, some key individuals within the medical community. We had then started conversations with Summit Biolabs out of Boulder, who were going to do our testing. So that was the medical conversation. And then, you know, the conversations that we were having with the local health departments. You know, we were operating in Pitkin County, and Pitkin County has one hospital bed, right? And all of their COVID cases needed to be moved out of the county and into Eagle County, where there was more resources and facilities to be able to support the COVID cases. So there was a lot of conversations, and ultimately, you know, it was our responsibility, and we had to submit this plan, and we did submit this plan to the CDPHE, which is the Colorado Health Department here. We had to submit our plan for approval, which we were in the process of getting, receiving that approval when we canceled the race, in order to be able to move forward with the permitting process. So it's, when I say collaboration, it was absolutely that on so many different levels and different conversations, you know, at the state level, at the city level, and at the county level, of course. And really our goal with this was, because things were changing so rapidly and because Pitkin County was in a different phase than Eagle County was, and Boulder and Denver County, we really felt that we wanted to make all of our stakeholders, I kind of cast that net broadly, because we were all in this together, and we didn't want any of our partners in any of the, you know, at any level to say, oh, well, that doesn't work for us. We wanted to make sure that we were communicating, this is what we're thinking, this is the path we're going down, how does that work, you know, specifically for the county and the phase that you're in, and what's the level of comfort from, you know, everything from the, you know, the city manager into the other levels of government, to the health departments, and to the community as a whole. You know, what are you hearing? How is that working? So it was a lot of conversations and a lot of vetting through it. Again, during this time, nobody really had a clear path on how to navigate, but we felt that this was the best path forward for us, is to be able to, you know, build this plan, get the support from our communities. And then ultimately, with this plan, we were in the process of communicating with the athletes and the teams and all of that. And ultimately, that's when we decided to cancel it. The event itself was, you know, we didn't have that 100% comfort level that everybody wanted to race and everybody felt safe racing. And though the plan was strong and had some great elements that we can go into here in a minute, the one thing that we, and we're very open about this fact, the one thing that we hadn't solved was, how do you mitigate risk within the Peloton? So the way that our 4-day event it was planned to take place is we did do 1 day of individual time trial. But, you know, once, even if you stagger a start and you put people six feet apart, once that neutral start is over, the athletes are going to form a Peloton, and you're shoulder to shoulder, they're sweating, they're spitting, they're breathing. There's really, within the sport and how the race happens these days, there's no way to avoid that. And, you know, we were doing everything to make sure that everyone who rolled up to the line was healthy and had been tested. But there was still that, you know, sense of concern that when you're in, what can you do about the Peloton? And that's ultimately where we, you know, made the decision. We didn't want to put anyone at risk. We didn't want to put our stakeholders up for any sort of, you know, scrutiny or irresponsibility, you know, within the communities. So despite all the work that we had done on this manual, and we felt very confident with it, there were still a few areas that weren't 100% there.
Once again, let me remind our listeners, we're speaking with Lucy Diaz. She's the CEO of RPM Events. They put on the Colorado Classic. We're going to take a real quick break, and when we come back, we're going to talk a little bit more about the nuts and bolts of this plan and how it will probably evolve as we go forward. You're listening to The Outspoken Cyclist. We are back on the show. I'm Diane Jenks. You are listening to The Outspoken Cyclist, and we're talking with Lucy Diaz. She's the CEO of RPM Events Group. It puts on the Colorado Classic, which, of course, for 2020 has been canceled. It is hopefully going to happen in 2021. But what RPM Events Group has done is put together a COVID mitigation plan. And what's very cool is they're offering it and all of the work that went into it and all of the resources to other events and ride and race directors if they are going to try to go forward with anything, even in the long term, not just the short term. So before our break, we were talking about some of the bullet points of the event itself and or of your plan itself, I'm sorry. And so some of the things you've done is you've modified it, you've got an extensive testing protocol, you've got race formats that have changed, you've got post-race format. I mean, there's so much to think about. If anybody's a ride or race director, you know all of the getting permits used to be the hardest thing we had to do. Now it's not, and figuring out the route. Now it's way more complicated. So just take us through a few of the bullet points of your plan and how it's going to look so much different from what we're used to seeing.
Yeah, I mean, I think first and foremost, the biggest change that we did with the racing format was we eliminated spectators. So we eliminated any ancillary event, any fan engagement opportunity, which is, you know, it's so ironic to be saying that.
And also, yes, it is.
You know, when you're as you know, right? It's producing the competition side of it is one thing, or the race side of it is one thing, and then it's, you know, how do we bring the fans in? How do we bring the energy? How do we, you know, drive the engagement between the athletes and the fans? And that was the unfortunate, you know, first step that we took with this and saying, well, let's take a step back and understand, you know, where exposure would exist for the athletes and for the race itself. So, you know, we developed a made for TV model. We eliminated expos. We eliminated any ancillary citizens rides or, you know, pre-rides of the course. We eliminated our VIP services and really worked to create a secure zone around the start finish line and team parking. It is the buzzword these days as it relates to COVID and sport is we created a bubble, you know, around the start finish line venue and the team parking. And that bubble was a restricted area that only pre-approved staff and obviously the athletes and their team support would be able to enter into. So really locking things down where, again, typically you're opening things up and you're wanting spectators to walk through team parking and, you know, have an opportunity to get photographs and signatures and all of that. So, I mean, that would be the most drastic change that you could see from the outside. And then we created a, I guess you could say, sort of a cadence of communication with the teams that was enhanced more than what we'd used to do, right? So typically we have the invites, we create the teams, we tell them, you know, this is the plan, this is where you're staying, this is so on and so forth, logistics, right? So you're communicating logistics. Now we're really creating a conversation and putting a responsibility onto the teams to make sure that their athletes are safe before traveling. So they're not getting on a plane if they feel sick or they have symptoms. So the protocols of the pre-screen. And we looked at the event really on a 14-day incubation period. So 5 days prior, 4 days of competition, 5 days post. And that was the time frame in which we would be monitoring and screening the athletes and ultimately testing once we get within that race competition. And then making sure as they leave, you know, we had a feel. So if somebody did come up with a positive test after they left the event, you know, we would be able to trace that and track that and communicate, you know, any sort of engagement that the athlete had had. So, you know, that piece was key and crucial to the success of, you know, the health and safety around the event. And then, you know, from a media perspective, we weren't going to have any on-site media. So we were going to do a whole virtual media room. So typically at an event, you know, we'd set up a media center and we'd have, you know, TVs and the stream of the event in there and interview opportunities and, you know, typically as you do. So all of that would have happened virtually. And it was, to be honest with you, it sounds kind of silly now thinking about it, but it was kind of a fun challenge to approach and saying, okay, how do we create a virtual media center? How do we revise our award ceremonies that aren't the typical, you know, stand up, get on stage, shake hands, put jersey on athlete, hands up in the air. you know, how do we revise and really rethink what those ceremonies look like in a less contact or no contact situation? And how do we do them so they're maximized for TV and for capture to be able to be streamed? So, you know, we did look at every single touch point, and we had functional calls with every area, you know, from volunteers. How are we going to screen volunteers and test them? And what are the measures that we're taking for them, you know, obviously to masks and PPP and, you know, restrooms. So a lot of considerations, which we have outlined in the manual or the risk mitigation guide that we have, and we have that available online. But, you know, it does run through the specific areas, you know, from we were providing masks for all of the athletes, which they would wear until they crossed the start line. They put it on after they cross the finish line, to, you know, how to place restrooms, how people line up to get into restrooms, hand sanitation, and really just kind of drilling down from there. So a lot of, again, additional thought processes that needed to take place on the sort of minutia within the event venue, even though it was, you know, restricted to those who had approval to enter.
Once again, let me remind our listeners, we're speaking with Lucy Diaz. She's the CEO of RPM Events. We're talking about the COVID mitigation plan that they've put together for the Colorado Classic, which is canceled for 2020. Going forward, Lucy, do you see a few of these elements or a lot of these elements becoming regular and making racing better?
You know, I hope so. You know, you think about where you place the porta potties, probably not going to make racing better. And maybe it's less about making racing better, but to be honest with you, it might be about making a more sustainable model. And I think that's something that we've struggled with pro cycling specifically on, is we're not getting ticket revenue. So, you know, we're relying on corporate sponsorship and community partnership to be able to drive the top line for these events. And there's a great cost, as we know, to shut down roads and to get permits and the infrastructure around the race itself. So from my opinion, cycling is storied with, you know, this rich history. And, you know, we look at the Tour de France as the pinnacle of the sport, rightfully so. It is, and it's, you know, legacy and its history and all of that. But I don't know that that model is a sustainable one in every instance, right? So trying to take a Tour de France type of infrastructure and model and event format and bringing it to Colorado, I don't know that that works, right? And I don't know the finances of the Tour by any stretch. I'm not trying to say that I do. But obviously they spent hundreds of years building around that and building that and the spectators and the excitement and all of it. So I think this practice is said, instead of just saying, all right, well, this is how pro racing always has been, COVID has caused us to stop and think, well, this is how it's always been, but no longer can it be that way. So what are things that we can do as a community, you know, as a race producer, but, you know, ultimately together, that we tweak the model slightly, that perhaps makes it more affordable, but ultimately makes it a better experience for the athletes first, but then for the spectators beyond that. When we pivoted to our women's only event, it's a non-starter to not have live broadcast coverage of the event. Because in our opinion, if these athletes are out here competing, if we don't give the world the opportunity to tune into that, then we're doing a disservice to the athletes, because they need a platform for promotion, they need a platform for exposure and engagement. And that's really part of our fundamental ethos here with Colorado Classic. So we had the technology and the know-how to do that. And as we were pivoting it, you know, within COVID, you know, it gave us an opportunity to say, okay, we feel very confident about our TV product. So therefore, let's double down on that almost. You know, what are ways that we can add more cameras to give different perspectives for the viewers, right? So you're not going to be standing at the top of a climb or lining the hill, you know, of the QOM. But, you know, how do we replicate that on-site experience that a spectator might have in a virtual environment? So it really has, as I mentioned earlier, it seems silly, but, you know, really pushed us to think differently, because we had to think differently. And ultimately, you know, there was a level of, I mean, financial scrutiny, maybe that's not the right word, but, you know, we looked at the finances of it, and it wasn't the typical model, right? We had to cut expenses, because when COVID hit, the sponsorship sales, you know, unfortunately stalled. And I don't think that should be a surprise to anyone. But just as we were going through this crisis and this pandemic, companies were being a little bit more, you know, conservative with their spends. So we, by nature, we kind of had to think about doing things differently or more cost effectively. I mean, even something as logistically focused as staff, where are you bringing staff in from? You know, how can we maximize our local staff as opposed to flying in people from around the country, which we typically do? Let's maximize our local staff. That saves on flights, that saves on hotels, you know, and there's a ripple effect from there. So, you know, one change or one implication within the event does cause, you know, different results from a, you know, from a financial perspective. We did a lot of combing through the budget and trying to explore areas, not to make it a worse event, you know, not to make it Colorado Classic light, but really to understand, you know, areas in which we could affect change or we had to affect change.
I guess to wrap it up, because we need to do that, unfortunately. Mm-hmm. It's a really interesting conversation, but I think maybe the time has come for cycling in the U.S. to look different anyway, and to make the sport more interesting and to make it more exciting. In Europe, you don't have to travel very far from one stage to the next. I think your ideas are really spot on, and I hope that out of them will come a new appreciation for pro bike racing in the U.S. Well, let's tell listeners, well, and especially if there are any ride directors, race directors, you've done all of this groundwork for them, which is really awesome. Tell them how they can find the COVID mitigation plan and then how they can find out more about the Colorado Classic going forward.
Thank you. I appreciate the opportunity to share. Our website is coloradoclassic.com. To download the COVID manual, it's coloradoclassic.com/COVID-19 manual. And there is also a form on there that, you know, if people have any questions or want to have a conversation with anyone on our team, we'd be happy to do that. And again, for us, this is about, you know, how do we make the sport better? We would love this to be shared far and wide. And we hope that somebody takes something from it and they say, I hadn't thought about that. This is great. And they put it into execution, you know, to help make a safe and healthy event.
Lucy Diaz, she is the CEO of the Colorado Classic and RPM Group. And I so appreciate you taking time to talk with me and so appreciate the work you've done to try and get us through some of this COVID dilemma when it comes to, well, when it comes to producing events. Thank you so much. I hope you have a great rest of your summer.
Thanks.
Take care.
Bye-bye.
Bye. Lucy Diaz is the CEO of RPM Events in the Colorado Classic. If you're interested in knowing more about the event, or if you want to download the COVID mitigation plan manual, you can log on to coloradoclassic.com. My thanks to Lucy, to Larry Silver, and Matt Pinder for joining me on the show this week. And my thanks to you for listening. Remember that you can always join the conversation on our Facebook page, send us a tweet at Outspoken Cyclist without the E, or leave a comment on our blog, OutspokenCyclist.com. I hope you have a great week. Stay safe, stay well, and remember, if you have a chance, go for a ride. Bye-bye.
Thanks for joining us today on The Outspoken Cyclist with Diane Jenks. We hope you enjoyed this week's show and welcome your comments and thoughts on Twitter and Facebook. Visit OutspokenCyclist.com to hear this and all past shows. We'll be back next week with more great conversation and news from the world of cycling. Remember, you can subscribe to our podcast on iTunes or Stitcher and never miss an episode. The Outspoken Cyclist is a copyrighted production of DBL Promotions with the assistance of WJCU-FM Cleveland, a service of John Carroll University. Thanks again for listening, ride safely, and we'll see you next week.